Alan Johannes. He's a singer, songwriter, revered guitarist, producer, and engineer, referred to by many in the industry as a musical genius. Johannes was born into a musical family in Chile in 1962 and started playing guitar at age 6. He grew up all over the world speaking multiple languages, and it was coming to the U.S. as a young teen where he met some friends and started a band, 3/4 of whom would later become the Red Hot Chili Peppers. But it was some years later, upon meeting his soulmate and musical cohort, Natasha Schneider, that his life would change. The duo create a partnership so powerful and unique, they're often asked to collaborate and act as a sounding board for their peers. In 2008, though, the unthinkable happened, Natasha's untimely passing from cancer, followed by the loss of both his parents and, more recently, his close friend and collaborator, Chris Cornell. Luckily for us, Johannes has soldiered on, releasing 3 poignant and beautifully orchestrated albums. We were fortunate to catch up with this musical giant and just as gracious human being from his home studio in LA recently, where he recorded his latest masterpiece, Hum.
Hello.
Hello. I'm good. Great. How are you?
I'm okay, you know, considering the insanity of the last year plus, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, everyone here at my sister's got it, and I managed to not get it. So I think I already had it twice in the last year and a half. Where are you? Where is that? Are you in the East Coast?
Right. Yes, New Jersey. I'm home in New Jersey.
Oh, nice. Perfect. Looks lovely.
Looks lovely where you are, too.
Yeah, I kind of commandeered this room at my sister's where I have I did Hum in this room, actually. I don't know if I can't really move the MacBook, but there's about 400 instruments all around me, plus a recording setup. So,
yeah. Oh, amazing. You created your LA place there, huh?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. You know, it's been a crazy time. Obviously, you know, we all wish we could be out there, touring and stuff. And I got stuck in Santiago for almost 5 months, and I managed to make my way back. It was pretty intense, but it's good to be back, you know, just kind of brewing the next set of recordings, because I don't think this year is going to be a touring possibility anyways, you know, so.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a new world, as they say. A lot of things are going to change, you know. I think if you're into being creative in the world of music, you're going to have to be really, really focused and, you know, persevere and be okay with being broke a lot. I've been doing it so long and the ups and downs were so, so intense. I'm used to all of it. I mean, and because the reason was always, you know, just to make music that, you know, would help us and help the world and the way the music helped us. And that was the same thing. Nothing's changed. It was, you know, at least for me, it wasn't to be more popular or to be rich or anything like that. It was just the love of music. You know, I mean, I was lucky to grow up in a household where there was constant music, you know, and everyone played an instrument or sang. So it wasn't like they definitely didn't try to stop me. You know, sometimes they kind of wish that because my grades were so good that I would get a straight gig, like an architect or doctor or something. Yeah, I even pretended by going to junior college for about a year. We're waiting. Jack and I both did the same thing. Jack Irons, we were hoping to get a record deal or at least get more popular so we could prove to our parents the whole thing was worth it.
Yeah, your mom was a singer. Your dad as well.
Yes.
Uncle, a musician.
My uncle Peter, he is the one that put a guitar in my hand. He was a multi-instrumentalist and entertainer. They were more in the entertainment, meaning like they, I didn't get that part of the gene, like the kind of like, hey, you know, it's like a really like good stage persona and all that. I'm more like kind of like the, you know, eyebrows and eyes closed and like, oh, like more Beethoven, like, you know, it's so heavy. And there's natural performers like Dave and Josh and Chris, you know. Though Chris was obviously.
Days you were dancing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there's one video where they forced me to dance, and it was really embarrassing. I try to pull it off as if I knew I looked really silly and I was just having fun with it because it was the 80s, you know. It was that Walk the Moon video. No, but you know, it's exactly the environment being very, very helpful was great, especially in terms of the music that was being played, because I naturally gravitated towards the Beatles, you know, in the 60s. So I would make my mom get me the singles, and I was kind of picking out the chords the best I could and singing frenetically. And then my grandmother loved like Charlie Parker and Art Tatum and Frank Sinatra. And so there was a lot of great jazz going on then in Mexico City, where we lived from 68 to 74, you know, when I was 6 till 12, my mom's hipster neighbors had, like, you know, really cool records, you know, obviously all of the jazz and the Jesus Christ Superstar soundtrack, and which I really gravitated to because it had a little bit of that connection to Prokofiev, you know, to Andrew Lloyd Webber's melodic things, very similar to some of that. And yeah, you know, it was a cool flamenco guitar was playing all the time. You know, I fell in love with Paco de Lucía. It's nice to have grown in so many different countries. I mean, grown up in so many different countries before arriving to the States when I was 12, because I kind of had this feeling of a world citizen already. Because I actually never really felt home. Like, I feel at home in anywhere, but I don't really feel like I belong to any one place. And that's one of the reasons too why I really feel comfortable and find it really enjoyable to tour, because, I mean, first of all, I'm a foodie, and that's always, you know, helpful touring and trying the cuisines from all over the world. And also, you know, how music manifests in different cultures it fascinates me. And I try to internalize as much of that as possible to kind of get at some kind of universal feeling in it. Or rather, as a listener, the things that I resonate with, I start finding this commonality, even though the form is not the same at all, in the sense of like, okay, these are time signatures, or the tuning is different than ours, it's more microtonal, or the scales are different, or, you know, obviously the language barrier in some ways, but you still kind of sense what, you know, the people are communicating honestly or with passion. And I love that. And that's why I love rock music, because you can do it all inside that umbrella. You kind of safely held together. I'm a rock musician. Well, what does that mean? You know, jazz musician is pretty specific, but you know, it can be, it's pretty varied and classical, you know, it's, but a rock musician could be anything from, you know, a three chord folk song that's really beautiful to like Frank Zappa and you know, all the prog music or, you know, the Swans. I mean, it just goes, you know, Fred Frith, you know, I love it. So, and the spirit of it. Sorry, I'm talking too much already.
No, it's so good. It's all good. It's all good. Yeah. You just wiped out about 10 of my top questions.
No, it's been a long path. And also it goes in so many different interesting directions, you know, the people that have met along the way.
Tell us about that for the people that don't know, you know, all the people that you've met along the way.
Well, let's see. When I moved to LA at the end of 74, I went to 101 Avenue for half a semester, then ended up at Bancroft Junior High, where I met, in my homeroom, I met Jack Irons. He was dressed as Gene Simmons for the talent show. And I barely spoke any English, but I don't know why, because that's not my nature at all. As he was walking down the aisle, he was sitting behind me. He has his Gene Simmons outfit, you know, that all made, because, you know, Hillel was involved in a couple of other friends. And so as he walked by, I just kind of punched him in the genital area kind of lightly. And he went, "Ow, you asshole." And I was just like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I thought it was protective." And then he told Hillel, "Is this kid at the homeroom, he just punched me in the whatever." He goes, "What's he look like?" "Oh, I think he's from Mexico. He's kind of got curly hair and he plays guitar." He goes, "Oh, I heard him. He's amazing. He's a great guitarist. I heard him the other day about whatever. We should jam with him." Anyway, so somehow we ended up getting together. And then obviously that was Hillel Slovak and Jack Irons. And it was before you know, we jammed with Flea. So we started our first band through junior high. It was called Chain Reaction, and then it was called Anthem. And then we had a bass player named Todd Strassman. And then in the 11th grade, he decided to concentrate on his studies. And then Flea was our friend that played jazz trumpet. And so he kind of came to my house and Hillel's house for some quick pointers on playing a string instrument, because the music he already had in him. And then he was our bass player. And so then that was the first band, you know. And then Anthony Kiedis was our schoolmate too, but he was more in the drama department, into doing plays. But he did help us out being our MC a few times. Then we left high school and kind of slowly morphed into Flea left and joined Fear. We got a different bass player. And then Anthony and Flea were living together. And our friend Gary Allen, their friend, was a performance artist, was playing at the Grandia Room and invited them to come up with something to open up the show. And so Hillel, Jack, Flea, and Anthony kind of brainstormed this concept, you know. And I remember being at Don Diva Stone's house when their name, trying to come up with names, figuring out what the name was going to be. Ended up being obviously Red Hot Chili Peppers. And then I went to see the very first performance, which is basically, I think, two or three songs. I already knew. I was like, oh, this is going to be trouble in terms of keeping the band because obviously it was awesome and people loved it. But we did. We tried for a couple of years there. We had two four-piece bands that were, you know, it was Hillel, Jack, Hans, and I, and then Chris Hutchinson and I as What Is This? And then look at those guys. So when we both got record deal offers the same general, I think the same week, Hillel and Jack stayed with me, and we went and did a record with Dave Jordan, and then Todd Rundgren produced the next one. By then, I had met Natasha. I mean, that was the biggest change. You know, I was 22 and I had a dream I was going to meet her. And the next day I met her. I knew her name from the dream. In my dream, she's across from me in this teeter totter, like on the edge of the forest. It's kind of dark. I can't really see her face. But she said, my name is Natasha. We're going to meet. And I told my mom about the dream. And then our mutual friend and our, you know, basically he worked at A&M, later ended up being instrumental in signing Soundgarden. So it's kind of a funny small world there. He had seen Natasha on television because she'd been in a few movies and TV shows, and she always talked about music. So he called her into a meeting and she said, I want to make a record, but I'd love to collaborate with somebody. I need somebody to bounce off of. And so without announcing it, he basically brought her over to my mom's place where I was staying, and she walked in and we met, and that was it. You know, like literally a week later, we moved in together. So then she joined the band, and then Hillel and Jack went back and to the Chili Peppers, and her and I formed a duo called Walk the Moon, like similar name to a recent one. And that's where the one video where I'm dancing exists from. And that was pre-11. And I think there was just like a duo in which her and I explored a lot more of the songwriting as opposed to the band dynamic. So pretty much anything could go without limitation. Just with, you know, these drum machines, we're just exploring things, and it was pretty cool. So then after Hillel passed away, it was during the time period where we were making our second record in England. Jack had a total breakdown, and it hit me really hard too. I had my first kind of mini, I don't know what you would call it, and panic attacks and all that stuff. It was really jarring because we were so close. But then so we formed 11. So Jack, Natasha, and I formed 11 already starting in 1990, in the seeds of that, you know. It's such a weird feeling because Natasha isn't here anymore. And I didn't know if I was going to survive that when she was gone. But Josh really took care of me. He got me busy straight away with Arctic Monkeys. He got me, you know, with him to engineer that record, and then the Crooked Vultures and all that stuff, the touring. But when I made Spark, when I made the record for Natasha, that's I felt her so present in the room and informing me with so many things that were happening. It was like literally, I think, 4 days that I did the whole record. And it was some kind of crazy, almost hallucinating stupor. I mean, I was drinking some, you know, vodka, which I don't normally do, but it was just so I could get kind of get in that zone. But it was amazing because it started this feeling that that I was kind of charged with this kind of legacy, or that as long as I was creating music in this way, in which, you know, which kind of waited for the inspiration to come. And since then, it's gotten to the point where every time I sit down, I mean, I just have to reach that energy level that is so like is burning in the plexus that now I know I need to make the record. That's why I made Hum after being ill, you know, last year. But I really mm-hmm. feel like she's there. It doesn't feel like a solo record. I mean, I have to call it that. But so now to me, it's like we had this funny connection, this relationship musically, where we kind of, and it kind of goes back to something that would happen when our friends started having kids and the kids started to be able to communicate. They would actually call both of us, Alan and Natasha. You know what I mean? Like they would sense like there's two separate people, but there's also they're both the same person, even yeah. though we're so different. So Alan and Natasha became this thing, you know, or Lennon and McCartney, or as he wanted, McCartney and Lennon to later. But yeah, anyway, so I when I'm in that process, and then when I play those songs live, is I feel connected to her, you know. And I'm not, you know, it makes it possible to not just feel. I mean, obviously the missing and the sadness of not being able to share. That's the thing, is not being able to share something. So I almost have this like safeguard where there's this mini Natasha inside my brain that's also existing next to me, my ego structure as a person I can talk to. You know, it's like, because we can do whatever, because we have no real proof of how this universe works, so might as well believe something really nice, you know, if it helps. So yeah, so that's the thing with making music and stuff. And that's one of the difficult parts of this last year, is not being able to go. I was had so many like European tours planned and stuff, but now to concentrate, I think concentrating on creating so that the work stays there, you know. I need to make more records. I realized it's like three solo records in 10 years. That's not a lot, especially because I'm posting little things on Instagram almost daily, you know, little improvisations. So I gotta get going on this. You know, I have some ideas for some instrumental music too.
Good. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
How has the social media helped in that way? Like, you know,
Instagram in particular, I'm not really that, I don't really use it as a, I mean, obviously it's nice to know that there's, you know, a decent amount of followers on Facebook and some on Twitter and on Instagram. But I mean, I've been on it for about 8 years now. And even before we could do video, or when we first could, and it was only 15 minutes long, I remember just using it like a sketch pad, you know, or like a travel log of ideas. And I found that psychologically, I was just more committed, knowing that it's in the beginning it would be like 500, then 1,000 people, then 2,000, and now it's up to like 43,000 or something like that, which is a lot of people. I mean, obviously not everybody, but like when you're going to put, you know, and I like to do it, so I don't sit there like, I'm imagining a lot of people put a lot of time in or repetition into getting a perfect recording or something. I'm the opposite. I like it to be spontaneous and raw. So I literally just feel the urge, or that it's time, and then I press record and I just start, and then I might record for, I don't know, a minute or two, and then I just go through it and choose a minute, or maybe it's the whole thing. I don't like sit there and go, oh, that wasn't good enough. No, this is not new. It's not about that. Is it? And so many of those bits have become, I mean, on Fragments and Holes, my second solo record, the entire thing is based on Instagram sketches and improvisations. And on Hum, the first two songs are from improvisations, you know, and the rest was kind of composed in the moment. But if I didn't have those first two, I wouldn't have been able to get started on that, you know.
Let's go back to 11 a little bit. Let's mm-hmm. talk about the history again. That's where you left off on 11. So
yes,
tell us, pick up there.
Yeah, so our first, so Jack's back, and obviously him and I've grown up together, and him and I and Natasha had this amazing chemistry. And we get signed to Morgan Creek, and we, you know, we didn't have the confidence to ask to work on our own stuff. We'd had studios and I've been around recording gear. That was to come later. But we were still kind of like open and stuff. And so we worked with E.T. Thorngren on that record. And the record ends up sounding a lot more polished and poppy than we actually sounded like live, you know. But the songs were also a little more like in the can. There was a little more Sly and Stevie influence and at that time. But when you heard it live, it sounded, it was even cooler because it was raw and darker and edgier. So that record ends up sounding a little bit, a little poppy for my taste, but there's some beautiful songs on it, you know. But what it did do was it got us this opportunity to go out there and start touring. Now we had met Soundgarden during those early shows, and we were already fans from before. Like, you know, they were listening to our early stuff, and Kim had been a fan of What Is This when he was a DJ and stuff. And we were listening to Bad Motorfinger, and we had heard earlier Soundgarden too, because Aaron Jacobus said that introduced Natasha and I was also instrumental in getting Soundgarden signed. So, or, you know, was when they were in A&M. There was this amazing kind of connection that we had with Seattle, because not only with Soundgarden, but with Pearl Jam, because, they had wanted Jack to be the drummer for Pearl Jam before in the beginning. And he had said, well, I'm just forming the band with, you know, my oldest friend and his girl, but my friend Eddie's a really good singer and you should check him out. And so Eddie, you know, goes up there and then he becomes a gen. And then, you know, this one tour that we had booked for a while, we kind of lost it to them because they had a better, a more powerful label and everything. And so they felt kind of a little bit bad. And so they invited us to open up for them for the first headlining tours that they did. So we ended up touring with them for a good part of a year and a half, you know, opening up, and then Soundgarden and back and forth. And that was just incredible years of 11 touring with Jack and stuff. And then Jack left in the middle of Thunk, actually, like he finished his drums and then left. And we knew, because Eddie we knew Eddie would want him to be in the band. And he was calling the studio, I think using Captain Crunch as his, you know, Captain Crunch calling for Jack. We were like, ah, oh, there's Eddie. Because we had asked Jack not to do it. We said, no, I mean, we didn't tell him not to go join Pearl Jam. We just said, if you're going to do it anyway, just do it before we do the record, because he's such a titan and such a unique voice on the drums that it's not going to be easy to find somebody, you know. So do it before, so we have that chance. So consequently, there's these Thunk B-sides, which is four songs that we took off the record so that Matt Cameron could come down and play drums on four songs, which were Why, No Ground, Big Sleep, and Seasick of You. Some of those vocals in Natasha's performance and Took Me for a Ride and you know, just insane. Yeah. And her singing on Echo, I get chills every time I hear her voice anyway. It's important to remember her and what a genius she was. And I try to remind people, but it's, you can't tell them how to hear or how to think, but it's like, she was not just a good keyboard player. She was not just a really good songwriter or a good singer. She was something completely other. And because I was around almost 25 years around her, it's like, I don't even know how to describe that kind of genius. You know, it's the things that you don't hear or that didn't end up on record. It's just her everyday, you know, I mean, the reason why Frank Zappa would call and whenever he got a new microphone and ask for, you know, Natasha to come over, just the texture of her voice so he could hear, you know. Yeah, I mean, just her ability to, like, you know, sit down at the piano and she just kind of composing her head like really fast right before playing it. And just because she had this childhood and being groomed to be a classical genius pianist and stuff, but she was pretty intense already in these classes with adults, and she was just in early teens or maybe 12 or 13, and you know, string quartet would come in and play a piece and no one had ever heard before, And then you had to basically just write down what they had just played, you know, in an 8-minute piece. And she always turned it in without mistakes before anyone else did, you know. Like, just that kind of photographic memory and the perfect pitch and everything, you know. But anyway,
you have it too. You have that gift too.
I'm more like the daring, fearless, you know, intuitive, not everything. I mean, I had an unfortunate very first experience with a teacher when I was six. That was kind of a little bit of a sadist, you know, enjoying, like, you know, hitting my knuckles in my hand with a ruler when I didn't get the bar chord to not buzz, which is hard when you're that small with a normal size classical guitar. And that for some reason I equated that with like going to school or being taught. So I decided to do it all on my own. Later on, I realized, you know, I wish I could have, you know, because it would have been interesting if I actually went to a conservatory or something like that. But I like this approach. Like, literally, I play all these instruments. At first, I sound like a total, you know, I mean, I actually have a pretty decent way of understanding an instrument enough to get some kind of a sound straight away. But then I practice a little bit here and there. And then suddenly I get a decent sound on it. And then it's ready anytime I need it for something to use in a song, you know. And I love sitting around like with my Indian classical instruments, which are obviously an entire lifetime's worth or several lifetimes worth of nonstop playing, you know. And I don't have that kind of I just love the sound of instruments and love textures. So anyway, yeah, so getting back to 11, so then now we basically have tour with Soundgarden, and now they're asking us to open up for them again, and now we have a new drummer. His name is Greg Upchurch. And we remember the letter he sent us from Oklahoma, me being a big fan, an actual physical letter. And so we go into Guitar Center to buy drumsticks or a snare drum or something. And he's behind the counter and he goes, "You guys are in love." And, "Oh my God." And he says, "Are you Greg? You're Greg from Oklahoma." Oh my. And so he auditioned for us and became the drummer. So so that's how we did for Avant Garde Dog. You know, Chris had stayed with us. He'd gotten after Soundgarden. So with Greg on drums, we opened up for Soundgarden for the Down on the Upside tour. And then after the band stopped after that tour for quite a long time, Chris stayed with us, and we did some things together like Sunshower, Ave Maria for the Merry Christmas Three. He got Alcafaro to come and listen to our stuff, and he gave us a record deal. We used the record deal. We asked him to give us the money for the entire budget to buy a studio for the house, and he somehow agreed. And then 2 days later, after getting the gear home, I had wired it up, and we started recording Avant Garde Dog, which we then finished. Then Chris came back, and we developed a bunch of stuff for Euphoria Morning. Natasha helped to arrange almost the entire thing, but we also wrote some things musically for him, like she wrote Pillow, I did Mission and Disappearing One. She worked with him tremendously on Steel Rain. I'm missing one too. Anyway, and so we had all these songs recorded ready to go, and we developed these demos, but the plan wasn't, you know, to do the record with him at the time. It was Daniel Lanois. And we basically, he, I think the day or two before we were supposed to start the pre-production or whatever, he canceled. And Natasha just said, when Chris goes, what am I going to do? It's like, you know, and Natasha's like, we have the studio. You got us a studio. We can start tomorrow. Let's do this. And next 7 months, we just spent locked up, and him going back and forth, and in Seattle coming back. And that's how we did Euphoria Morning. And then Avant Garde Dog didn't come out till afterwards, because A&M had asked us to wait so we could concentrate on being, you know, Chris's band and touring Euphoria Morning. And that's why it came out in 2000, because then A&M folded or got bought out, and then we had to wait to see what was going to happen. But the good news, you know, not that any, there was no label that ever promoted us, but the good news about that was that that's how we got to meet Queens and Josh and everybody, because now we're in Interscope, and so, and they're putting Rated R out, and Avant Garde Dog's coming up. And so we already had, had met Joshua. He'd seen us at Matt Cameron's wedding where Natasha and I sang Ave Maria. And he those guys are 11. Yeah, why don't we do this this tour? And so we played the West Coast shows, you know, with, and that's the friendship became instant, you know. So at that time, if Nick was in the band, and Gene Troutman and Dave Catching, and Brandon, I think, was there too. And then he invited me to record their B-sides at Sound City. That's the first time I got to work on that beautiful console and studio. And then Desert Sessions, right? So he goes, boom, 7 and 8. Natasha and I go out to the desert. Actually, I went out first. She didn't like the desert. So I went and literally drove back to bring her back again, because I said, you don't understand. It's going to be amazing. This Rancho La Luna studio, the vibe, the atmosphere is perfect. You're going to get out there, which is great, because next thing you know, the Nada and Up in Hell, her and Goss singing into the same microphone. I mean, that was a magical experience. And I wrote Hanging Tree and Making a Cross right there in the porch in the morning before recording it. That's where I met Lanigan for the first time. And I just started that whole other side of our lives, which is like being around and part of the Queens of the Stone Age, from being involved in Def, not only as the Mexican DJ and Natasha as the womb DJ. But I'm doing like theremin and flutes, and No One Knows, and Natasha's doing piano. And then obviously after that, you know, Lullabies being part of the band, her and I being part of the tour, the 2005 touring outfit, you know. Yeah. We did another record around the time of our very last record. We were working on what could have possibly been the sixth one. And I have a few tracks, but sadly, of course.
Yeah, are you ever going to do anything with those?
Yeah, I mean, I've got the songs. I had a plan for a second to you know, it's five songs, so I guess. Lanigan to sing one, Josh, Chris, you know, and then obviously now Chris is gone. And then, yeah, so part of me is thinking that it's been so long that maybe I should just imagine what the melodies would have been like and just kind of finish it out, you know. Because instrumentally, it's incredible. We recorded both, literally, I think in 2 days we did these recordings, which sound so full already, you know. And we had this kind of weird, it was so nice to be back with Jack. You know, we had done, you know, Howling Book and put it out on our own around the time of Songs for the Deaf. And this record, you know, I think I will. I also have I can probably share those with you. Trying to figure out when or how to release them. They're just some 8-track recordings from between Thunk and Avant Garde Dog, which are really interesting. Greg's playing drums.
Love to hear.
Yeah. I think there's a couple on there that you would just like. And the only thing left is a DAT that I digitized. And one song is a bit of a digital glitch, which can't be fixed, but it's short, you know, whatever goes by. But I tried to reconstruct the master tapes, and it was on this old machine that I tried to find one, and I did find one, and then realized that not all the stuff was on there. So there's not really any point of trying to remix it, but I think it sounds good as it is, you know. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been getting to play that music again with my trio in South America has been interesting, you know.
Yes, I thought that was so great. I love that you're doing that. So it's possible that they can hear those 11 songs live again.
That's yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. We play quite a few of them. There's a live album that we just put out on Bandcamp. Sadly, I mean, it's really good. I mean, I wish my voice was a little bit better. I had just been through this pretty intense thing. I had to cancel the first one of those theater shows because we played this show in the north of Chile, and they had this really old setup, and the fog machine malfunctioned and it burned the shit out of me. It burned my throat so bad that I ended up not being able to make a sound out of my throat for about 6 weeks. Yeah. And so I had to, you know, the doctor came right before the show. It was 2 days later that the theater show that I had to cancel and reschedule, which is where the show is from. So I'm not 100%, but at least it's in there, you know, it's passionate, you know. But I had a bit of bad luck with that. It's just literally like, it wouldn't turn off. And it was one of those Spinal Tap moments where like, it's just like below, it's below me and I'm completely enshrouded in this kind of oily, old school, toxic kind of smog machine. It's all right. It's all right. But anyway, yeah, those guys, you know, they grew up listening to Eleven and the brothers and Coté and Fellow. And they're, when they do their background vocals and they do some of the Natasha harmonies, it's like, you know, you get a little bit like, oh my God, so you get chills because they really know how to approach it and the feeling of it, you know.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Great. On your words, how do you come up with those words? I heard you mentioned Chris, and I heard you say that sometimes when you used to hear the things he wrote, you were like, whoa, like how do they do that? But that's how I feel listening to your words. They're so deep. Like one of the things I was thinking, like both of you, and Natasha as well, when you're together and even your solo stuff now, I mean, you've been through so much loss, but even the old stuff is so deep. It sounds like things that only people that have been through some stuff, you know, would come up with. You know,
no, thank you. Yeah. Well we were always concerned with existence, you know, and suffering and how to make it how to try to be part of the positive or the good part, or how to be empathic and I mean we were already empathic, but just like what, like lyrically in 11 especially, very, it was often a reflection of our search, you know, for meaning and connection, like how, you know, love is, you know, sometimes we're throwing like these quantum physics kind of concepts in there because it had this weird way of like there being like a ghost in the machine or like you know, not just a strictly chemical accident universe of physical, like it doesn't have to be you know, 100% religious dogma, fantasy, mythology that keeps changing all the time throughout history, or pure scientific. It's somewhere like the magical universe, the magic in there. And very often in the arts, you feel that, you know, like, I don't know, I can read some poetry, like, you know, and hear a piece of music, and suddenly you feel this connection between everything. And so we were really concerned with that. You know, we read a lot of books. We'd go to this, I don't know if you've been to LA, to Bodhi Tree in LA, but it was really cool. Like the books have been around forever. It's gone now. But you know, it's like, okay, now we're reading this thing about reincarnation. Okay, no, never mind that. Now we're reading this thing about, oh, no, look at the Kabbalah. Like, is this, okay. Oh, now there's, oh, wait, Joseph Campbell. I read all of those. Okay. And so there's always this searching going on. And I had a, you know, throughout the years, quite a bit of, we both did, you know, panic disorder here and there. And so to cope with that kind of thing, you just start to kind of like get into meditation and things where you like to, you know, think about life and explore things about life. And what always, we always got back to is connection and between all things and just the process of that, of like feeling connected to that, to the muse, to the beauty in things, to the best in people and all that stuff, you know? So that was what we're, you know, and obviously sometimes a bit of a British sense of humor or some kind of funny things going on there. That kind of a little bit of abstract logic where you know, I was a big fan of E. Cummings growing up and Charles Bukowski too, with the poetry and stuff, and I love that, having grown up with Romance languages, so suddenly in English there was this economy that you could achieve with the English language, and throwing certain words together created this tension and exploded the meaning into this kind of like holographic, something much bigger than in a romance language. You would often have to like make it very long-winded to be able to describe exactly that. But this is not even about describing exactly that. You could describe a feeling. So very often when I'm writing lyrics, I don't sit there and work on a line and go, this could be better or revise. And I never have revisions. I literally just wait, sit there like kind of like in tune and try to, once I get the first, sometimes it's a title, but once it's more of a core feeling, I have to have that first, you know, and then it just kind of comes out, you know, and it's literally like the emotional aspect of it, or the intensity, that energy of the feeling of it, or the place that you've arrived at psychologically or whatever it is, you know, that kind of just speaks directly into that line, you know, and that's why the line has power that continues, because very often I find myself reacting to it as if I heard it for the first time when I'm on stage. Like if I have to do Unfinished Plan, I usually try to save it towards the end of the set because I know it's going to, you know, it's going to fuck me up. You know, so pardon it's going to mess me up, you know, because I have to, you can't just casually sing those songs, you know, about Natasha folding into the weave to never say bye, you know, all these just images and all these ideas. I mean, her strength, you know, battling her cancer and how she remained positive and unwavering. And that's why it's so shocking to everybody that around us and everybody that knew her, because she was like, survived the craziest things in her life, you know, in Soviet Russia, being a little Jewish girl and, you know, deciding to just to defect or, you know, ask for asylum and arriving with nothing, you know. Years before they could even get around to, you know, any kind of, you know, it's just so, anyway, so there was so much, I mean, it, especially with the solo stuff and now thinking about Chris too, and sitting down and writing those lyrics is like, it's just, I just basically picture, you know, conjure them in a sense. I go through the memories of the experiences that we had together and what it feels like to miss them, or even more so the blessing of having known them and having shared existence with them for whatever period of time. That is kind of like feeds the words, you know. It's almost like it, you know, I guess I can say it just writes itself, because it kind of did. It wasn't, but granted, it took me a while to get to the point where I knew I was ready. I was laying in bed like ill for, you know, that period of several weeks, almost two months or so, just hoping that I would, you know, be able to get out of it. And then the second it was, I knew it was, because I literally got up, did this record, and then I got on a plane to go to South America to play Lollapalooza, and then on my way to Europe, and then I got stuck. I mean, I went from being sick to making the record to, I had 2 days where I did the videos for Hum, and then Liam did If Morning Comes, and then I got to Chile the 4th of March, and I got back late August. So it's, trying to get back, obviously, you know, but it was pretty heavy lockdown over there too. Anyway, yeah, so that's that. And I think with Chris's words, you know, too, I remember him sitting, often he'd be working on lyrics when he was writing melody and lyrics to the songs that we had written the music for. And I could sense, I could see the way that he would, you know, he would look up and you feel his energy when he was working on that stuff. It's just a lot to do with, you know, what he'd lived through, and not only externally, but internally, you know, when you deal with, a lot of artists are born with a hypersensitivity to existing, you know, and hyper empathic. And so they feel everyone's pain and suffering and their own. And for me, like one of the reasons I started having panic attacks as a little kid, I was like 7 or 8, was this kind of this kind of clash between the world as it was, and then what I imagined it could be. Why do people have to behave so awfully? You know, why can't everyone just, you know? So I knew people that were sweet to each other and kind, and or they could be sometimes, and then suddenly there's other side, and then you know at the time I was watching the news or whatever, or I could see violence around me in the neighborhood, or abuse or whatever, and then just suddenly, just why? That's, you know. And so that kind of how to reconcile those two things is like when you're a kid, you know, I think it started giving me a lot of anxiety. That and visiting the tombs, the Aztec tombs, which I went in on my own, and I was just, don't do that when you're a little kid. Mm-hmm. Walking around those catacombs, it was just like, ooh, you know.
How has it progressed, you know, since Natasha? How has it evolved? Stupid question, but
No. Because I think it's definitely changed.
And the Chile trip and meeting your father. And
yeah, exactly. I mean,
you've been through so much, man.
When Josh said, because he knew that I'd never met my real father, you know, because him and my mom, anyway, you know, he they were both too young. And he had his career and stuff, and she had hers. And so I wasn't supposed to know that I had that my, you know, that I had a real father. I thought my stepdad was my father.
Yeah. And, how was that? Like,
it was my grandmother that basically said, laid down the he shall never know. And then she's the one that broke the rules. So my mom was really upset. She's like, what did you know? So, and she didn't tell my mom she was going to tell me. She just kind of blurted it out one day. And like, I was in my 20s, and at the time of after the WTF moment, I'm like, well, what am I feeling here right now? Am I curious? I'm like, I guess not really that much at the moment. I mean, he would have reached out, whatever. That kind of under the rug. Then he sent me a letter a few years later, and I didn't quite know how to like said, am I feeling something or whatever? And so I didn't address that. And then time passed. And after Natasha passed away, he sent me an email, but it was a lot of things. So I didn't. Then Josh goes, you know, so you know what you need? We're touring South America. You're going to come and open for us, and you're going to meet your father. You know, it's time. I was like, okay. Cause I hadn't been back to Chile. You know, I was born there in 62, left in 63. I mean, not willingly. I mean, my grandmother kind of went. And now it's 2000, you know, 2010. And I'm back whatever amount of years passed, you know, 46 years or whatever, right? And I get there and my dad cancels. And then I realize, okay, well, because he hasn't heard from me. He sent me two things and I haven't responded. So that's it's my bad. So I emailed him. I said, listen, I totally get it. You know, I'm so sorry I didn't reach out. It's been interesting and complicated. But I think we should hang out anyway because I don't care about the past. I just want to see if we can, you know, be friends and et cetera. Yeah. So then I came back around, went with Queens to the play Columbia at a couple of other places. And I came back on my own. And my friend Axa booked a free show at Rock y Guitarras, which is, you know, blew my mind because first of all, my dad was there and my uncle Peter were there. So the night before that, he shows up with my brother. I have two brothers, Marcos and Daniel, and they've become really close with my entire family. A lot of cousins and, you know, and my aunts. And anyway, so he brought him and we bonded and it's next, you know, it was all pretty much chill. And so the next day he's driving me around, showing me the different sites in Santiago and taking me I grew up here. I played here. This is where I used to rehearse at the studio, recorded my first thing. You know, it was amazing. Then he came to see the show and it was amazing. And I started like, you know, the intro to Endless Eyes and it's 700 people in this club. And Spark had just come out, like, you know, weeks before. And I opened my mouth, and this 800, like 700 people singing the song with me, like full throat. I was like, whoa. So that was really intense. Okay. It was such a beautiful homecoming from everybody, you know?
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And I see my dad by the soundboard, and he's got a big grin, very proud and everything like that. And I got to see him I came back every since Chris brought me back the next year. We played the Maquinaria Festival. I did solo. Then I joined him for his solo set. Then I came back one time. I went there to play with my. I started already my band with Cote and Fellow. It was a quintet, and he wasn't around because he was playing some cruise tour, you know. So it was like that. It was really cool. He ended up passing.
I was on a cruise once.
What's that?
Best concert ever. My husband and I saw that boat cruise.
It was cool.
11. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Best thing we've ever seen. It was so
cool. Oh, I talked my way on
because I didn't have a ticket. We're like, what? I missed this.
It was amazing. Do you remember how we made them? We made them change the angle because we were gonna we had positioned the microphones a certain way, and then we realized that it was gonna make everything was gonna knock over with emotion.
I just remember it was the best thing I've ever seen. My husband.
That was so much fun. And that was, remember that we had an opening act that the self-appointed? They drove up on the little boat?
Nope. I don't remember.
Oh my
that.
God, it was amazing. It was amazing. It was kind of like while we were still, it was probably way before we started playing, but they were from Jersey, I think, or Long Island. They were from Long Island, and they were in a boat all packed together like this, like in a video. And they pulled up alongside, and they said, we're 11's opening band. And I forgot their name. I wish they did.
I'm sure my husband would remember.
It was amazing.
That was amazing.
Yeah, so I forgot what we were talking about. It's just a
new you were talking about how your trip to Chile and how the sound has evolved. And you said it has evolved. So how so?
So I went down there with Spark and then my mom and she had moved in with me. She had been ill before Natasha, and she had survived her first round with a fight with cancer. And then she moved in with me, having had some nursing experience and stuff to the last month of Natasha's life. And then she stayed, and I would go and play and tour. She took care of stuff at the house. She took care of me, and then she got sick again, and then I was taking care of her for a few years. Then she passed away on the 2nd of January, and my dad passed away on the 30th of January. And there was a new moon on that 2nd and a new moon on the 30th. And I was just like, are you kidding? It's like, it's like, what are the odds of this two new moons in the same month? So I did make my way down. My brother told me and texted me that, dad's gone. And I literally just went in the car and bought a ticket on the way to the airport and got a suit and everything, so I could arrive just made it. And that spring after that is when I did Fragments. And so this time I decided to try to expand the palette and use a much bigger instrumentation. I already had all the sketches, ready to go. Which would be all become songs. Almost every one, I think every single one was already present in some form. I should go back and find the original ones. That would be really interesting to see what it became. But there's some songs there, about my mom, about my dad. Whispering Fields is about my mom. That lyric in particular, it's like if you've ever been to in a hospice type, and walk through the hallways in one of those places, where she was, because she didn't want to. She made my sister promise to take her to a little hospice facility as opposed to dying at the house. She didn't want that. Where Natasha had passed, and anyway. I just ended up like playing drums, which, I play all the instruments here and there. So I had to practice drums, and what I would do is I would set up a really long recording time because we had, you know, inside Pro Tools and no tape. So like a 2 minute break and then the song, right? With a count off click track. So I would do like six takes in a row over a period of 40 minutes and hope that I could edit together a good performance. and it ended up working great. But I mean, I was just alone in the house, so there was no engineer. I had to go from one room to the other where the drum set was in the living room and all the way across the thing. So I had to put the start. That's why I give myself 2 minutes in between and to move around. Yeah.
You all set self-taught with all this stuff? You didn't have
to. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my process is like I just listen to something, whatever music or instrument that I just absorb the texture of it, and then it really helps to see somebody playing it, and I watch their body language, and obviously what are they doing, like how are they holding the embouchure, like how does the mouth look like, what do the fingers look like, is it what the angle of this, their position, and I kind of imagine being them. And so then when I get the instrument, obviously besides doing research on like the proper tuning and maintenance and whatever, I literally have quite a good head start. Within minutes, I'm getting a decent thing out of it, you know? Like, I loved the Last Temptation of Christ soundtrack. So Jovan Gasparyan is playing Duduk on it. And it sounds like, you know, this very human voice kind of thing. It's a little double reed, like, you know, it's a reed bamboo thing. And I got one, and it basically sounded like a really angry duck, you know? And I was just like, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing yet. I hadn't seen anybody play it. So I finally found some footage, and I see that it's holding a little and doing this thing with his mouth. And then I went and grabbed it, and I was like, oh, okay. And within a few minutes, I started getting a decent sound. Yeah, so, I mean, with all this stuff, it's just self-taught. It's like, you know, reading about it and then experimenting, you know, and having a good it's almost like you have an idea in your mind of what the sound is that you're after, even on recording. And it's been like that, like, okay, I hear it in my mind's eye, and now this is the reality. So how do I get this closer to that? So, okay, move the microphone or try this, or, you know, all that in the recording process, and all of it is just it really helps to have an idea, to imagine being great already. And you're basically just tracing your steps, you know, to your future self that already, that's my mental trick for Hum was that the album was already done. And all I had to do is tune into what it is that it is in the future and do exactly that so that it will be that, you know. So that's what? Nice. I don't know if that makes any sense, but okay, it's already exists somewhere, right? So I just tune in to that, like breadcrumbs, you know, or yeah. So that's what I did with Hum. It's like I would wake up in the morning and after the first two songs, I had nothing except the silence after the first two songs passed. Like what's next, you know? And that's how all the songs came about, you know. After Hum, everything after was just me getting up in the morning and writing it and recording it and then mixing it at night and then the next day. So it moved. I took one day off in between before 9. So I took a day off, and I got playful with the drum machine for that one. So just because I was just kind of like a reset or whatever, you know.
Would you say music is your therapy?
Absolutely. It's not only therapy, because I actually look at it as like the time I feel the most connected. And it's a strange thing. Like if I'm feeling like really lost or something, that then it's really hard for me to engage in music. Like I can play an instrument or just kind of grab something for comfort, but I really have to feel pretty decently good to even attempt it, because I don't like to, I'm especially lately, I'm not used to trying. I'm used to doing. So in other words, I just need to be in the right space so I can just, you know, go ahead and create something and record something. Thankfully, I go back and forth between, you know, helping others with their music and producing stuff and mixing things and mastering things and doing guest spots, and which is really nice because that's a little bit less pressure, you know. I can pretty much do that anytime, you know, or play an instrument, learn an instrument. And right now I'm just trying to get my health back, you know, together. It's been, you know, quite a few, you know, about, I would say even before Natasha got sick, and, you know, I would say like, yeah, 15 years of like, you know, me, I'm trying to like get the diet right and then lose the weight and then eat well and just have it stay that way. I mean, I quit smoking a few years back already and cut out the booze and all that stuff. And not that, you know, it was ever a problem type of thing, but you know, this is, wine is nice and, you know, it feels good to have a glass. And so when you realize you've been having almost every single day of the week, you had a glass or two, then you're like, maybe it's not good.
I know.
I'm actually lately I've been enjoying this thing I've never experienced before, which is like what happens when I mean, of course I've moved, I love walking and this, and every once in a while, you know, would go to the gym, but when you actually walk for like 3 hours or go hiking and you know, you get really achy and stuff, but you get to this place. I've been enjoying like the walking in kind of wild areas here. There's a couple of cool parks and trails. And just being around nature is just great, especially because this past year we're all so cooped up, you know. Yeah. It's nice to be able to get out.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, good. I'm glad you take care of yourself.
Thank you.
And after the pandemic's over, what else are we going to expect from you? What else do you plan? What are some things you want to do that you haven't done? Besides those five songs I want you to finish.
Yes, exactly. I need to finish those. I definitely need to get on a more focused, like, a lot of the stuff that I do just naturally, like, as part of my daily process of, you know, improvising or posting little things, like I should follow through and make them create, you know, into records or releases, the kind of release more of my process, or focus my process more into leaving more music behind, because it's like, I've got, especially because I think I'm definitely pretty connected now to it, so that I can do some good stuff. I feel very creative and in a good place, you know, in terms of that. So a couple of instrumental records, another solo record. I'd love to collaborate more, you know. So many awesome friends that I have, and we've been kind of getting used to like doing it remotely, but I'd love to travel and kind of collaborate, you know, if it's possible this year or next. I'm sure by next year, you know, it should be, but I have some, you know, love to go to Europe and spend some time there. I'd love to do a US tour, you know, finally, like as soon as we can, you know, an acoustic tour. I haven't done a US and Canada tour solo ever. You know, I've played in South America and I've played in Europe. Actually, I did a few shows with Fistful of Mercy a few years ago, but the Vodka and Gogol Bordello tours, that was in Europe too, you know. I haven't toured enough in the States. And it'll be easy. I'd love to just get inside a you know, a van or something, and, you know, with one friend, and just go drive around and do it. I mean, I think it'd be really great. It can just be a little PA and set up outdoors. It doesn't have to be, you know, a big to do. I mean, hopefully, I guess everyone has to get vaccinated or a lot of people before they'll allow that to happen, right? So we're still thinking of the fall, right? Nothing before the fall, I don't think. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'd love. I'd love to just do more, and then I'll obviously get as healthy as I can, and just keep doing it. That's the.
What do you want to play with that you haven't played with already?
I've been pretty lucky. I'd love to do more music with my friend Nick Acosta. She's an incredible singer. I'd love to make a record with her someday. She joined me for the Chris Cornell tribute at the Forum. She did an incredible Disappearing one. I played Cigar Box and stuff. And then she joined us for Can't Change Me and Preaching. I mean, Josh and I are due to do something together, just the two of us at some point. You know, it'd be really nice, even though, you know, we've just been doing stuff in Queens and Desert Sessions, but it'd be really nice to do like something like that. Yeah, I mean, there's some great artists that I love. Ruben Nilsson from Unknown Mortal Orchestra. You know, I got to interview him for the Dario series. He's super creative. I love his stuff. So maybe it's someday some be cool to collaborate with. And then, you know, on Instagram, there's all these really amazing musicians showing up in, which I'm really digging, you know. This bass player named Mono Neon is incredible. Yeah, I mean, my friend Nosfell, I don't know, I did a record for him years ago, but he's a super talented French artist, and we're due to do some stuff at some point, you know. So we'll see. Hopefully, Alessandro Cortini and I, we just did the Ghost Recon Breakpoint music there with Norm, our friend Norm. Three of us were involved in that. And Alessandro is a huge fan of Elevens and Euphoria Morning. And he's super talented, incredible musician in every way, not only in the synth world, but everything else. So I'd love to do some stuff with Alessandro in the future. And, you know, I think we will. So there's plenty of people to collaborate with, you know, plus whatever unknowns there still are, which there always are, like surprises, you know, whatever fate's going to bring. Hopefully I'll have to look out on Bandcamp for a couple of instrumental records pretty soon, which I'm going to start hopefully next week creating, you know. It's going to be interesting. Just strictly instrumental stuff. I think the first one's going to be like almost like a meditative ambient, but thematic too. Something that I've used all year to kind of relax. And whenever the angst and stress of confinement or the state of the world, stressful as it has been these past few years, something like that, you know, something that is, that you can actively listen to, but also kind of chill to, you know. So I'm calling it Reveries, you know, Reveries Volume 1, just in case it's a Volume 2, which is like little daydreams. We're kind of working on the cover now, which I sometimes do have a cover before I have a music.
Yes, you design the covers too, right?
Even yeah, that. Sometimes. Yeah, well, with my friends, you know, I did the last few 11 ones. Actually, the Thunk is a funny one because that was a sketch I did really fast to give the art department. I see you have it back there. You see the poster.
Yeah.
I did that. The idea of the apple on top was a quick like a Photoshop sketch thing that I gave to the art department. And they were supposed to realize it in a more professional manner. And then the end, and I think we ran out of time or something happened and we just went with it. And I know it looks so lo-fi, but I think it's pretty funny.
I love it. I have a couple of shirts.
Cool. That's awesome. I mean, there was always cool people at the labels, you know, that were trying to champion us. It can be just bad luck, you know, and it can happen like it's several times because the system wasn't, especially because we were never, okay, like for example, paraphrasing someone that was in a meeting, at a marketing meeting for Avant-Garde Dog, right? Interscope. And so they said that the head of promotion said, oh, I know them. They've been around for a while. Yes, they're very talented, but I mean, it's so strange. There's a guy, there's a girl. It's too alternative for rock. It's too rock for alternative. It's too this for that. It's too related. Then what is it? Is it Captain and Tennille? It's like, it like that? In other words, it's like, oh, it's like it wasn't, it's not any, but at the same time, it was so, I mean, I would love that. It's so wacky. It's like, wait a second, they both sing and wait, once what? And like, you know, it's what, you know, and it's funny, Natasha and I used to write songs, write music in a sense to fill, like both being fans, like what we would love to hear something. What haven't we heard? What particular manifestation of music is missing out there? And we kind of just said, okay, well then we'll just write it, kind of a thing, you know? So that's where this 11 has these multi things happening, multi layers happening. And it doesn't fit into a particular. We were lucky to have been included in the. And people thought we were from Seattle because we would get lumped into the grunge thing, Beavis and Butthead, and well, you know, it's great. And we had many opportunities, but the good thing is that it's people are continuing to discover it and listen to it, and that's the good thing. I then, you know, one of the saddest parts of all this is that Natasha really didn't get to, she didn't really get to experience firsthand how much love there was out there for her and for our music. Because when she passed away, you know, 2008, there wasn't really like a post the effect of the amount of people uploading to YouTube and listening on YouTube. You know, it's a long time ago. It was what, you know, what is it, 13 years ago. So it wasn't like, if you listen, see all the views and all the 11 songs on YouTube and people discovering it for the first time, it's all in the last 10 years or less, you know.
Wow.
It was all so sudden and also so shocking that it happened. But then our friend, a mutual friend, Randy, she told me that Natasha told her once that she didn't want to grow old. And I'm like, okay, well, she would have said that to me, I would have had a thing or two to say about it. She knew not to say that to me ever, because I would have just immediately just like not rested until I changed her mind and made me promise that her mind had been changed. So I don't know. Yeah, but then, you know, it's so young, 52, and Chris was 52, and Frank Zappa was 52. Just so bizarre, you know?
So I never thought of that. Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy. You had a lot of losses. I'm so sorry for all your losses. So.
Oh, no, thank you. I mean, you know, we all do. Life is... It's like that. I just, you know, I mean, I can't wrap my head around them, you know, completely. Chris being gone just makes no sense to me. But, you know, but at the same time, it's just like this continuing inspiration, you know. And I just hope that we're all taking every stock of everything that's good and focus on that, and also work hard towards making the world better, you know, now that there's been this really hard reset, you know, because there's a possibility of it going bad or better, you know, so might as well. And I just, you know, I just hope that anyone that is that feels a call and a passion for music, that you stick to it. Stick to your guns and know it's going to be hard. And it was hard for me sometimes. Sometimes it was easier, but that was in a time when it was in general a little bit still, you know, now with streaming and no touring and whatever, it's going to be disastrous for a lot of super creative people. So just it's worth it, because obviously I never had a choice. You don't have a choice. You just have to do it. I mean, I just, that's all I know. How to be is a musician, you know, an artist. And yeah, I mean, you know, people need it, you know, it's important for all of it. I'm happy to see that more poetry's coming back and people read more books, you know. that's good. yeah
that's true. And so it's old is new again and comforting. And
yeah. I mean, imagine like going to see live music again. It's like, yeah, you know, that feeling of experiencing things together. I mean, the live streams thing was and I've been doing I've been watching and paying for some really cool shows on the weekends here and there. To support a lot of my favorite jazz musicians and stuff, you know, and it's great. You know, you can see it, you can hear it. Obviously they put emphasis on the sound being good, but it's just that you don't have that feeling of being in the room with the electricity with other humans experiencing something that is in the moment. So, you know, hopefully that will all come back in some way eventually. So
thank you so much.
My pleasure. This has been great.
Oh my God, you made my everything. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. So if it's one good thing the pandemic has done, it has let me talk to you. So I'm so grateful for that.
Thank you. And I'm grateful too as well. And I appreciate, you know, and I'm thankful for your passion and understanding and support and all that. And that's why it's so lovely to talk about all this stuff with, you know, and remember our girl Natasha and Chris and the on and this crazy road that we've all been on, you know.
Can I get you to do a Life Minute shout out?
Yes. So Life Minute, lifeminute.tv.
Yep.
are we watching or listening?
Watching.
Okay. Ooh. Oh, this is Alan Harnest. This is lifeminute.tv.
Alan, thank you. God bless you. Take
thank
care
you.
Of yourself.
Thank you. You too.
Thank Take you. Care. I love you.
I love you too. Thank you.